Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Jesse Katz, who is a contributing writer at Los Angeles Magazine and the author of The Opposite Field. A former Los Angeles Times staff writer, he has earned numerous honors over a three-decade career, including two Pulitzer Prizes for Spot News Reporting and the Penn Center USA Award for Literary Journalism. His latest article featured in the Los Angeles Magazine is Escape from Cuba, Yasiel Puig's Untold Journey to the Dodgers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jesse Katz.
Ian, it is really nice to be with you.
And this is an amazing story, and of course, it's an open-ended one, right? I don't know where to begin, and I'm sure as a writer, you didn't know where to begin with the story.
This isn't sports talk radio, right?
No, this is not. This is news analysis. So I'm more interested in the politics of this as opposed to how many home runs he's hit. But I get it that he's incredibly popular. And that he saved, put the Dodgers back on the map, right?
Right. I mean, it is part of the story, the fact. I mean, if he was a mediocre player in the major leagues and had gone through this, we probably wouldn't be spending as much time talking about him. The fact that he is physically, exceptional and plays with this kind of emotional exuberance and fearlessness and does boneheaded things out on the field as well. That's just part of the mystique and the reason why people are so fascinated by him.
Right. Well, we don't expect our athletes to be rocket scientists, though, do we?
If we did, we have a long history of being disappointed. I mean, one good starting point is it's so tempting to want to view baseball through this kind of nostalgic lens, right? We think it's our bucolic national pastime. And, if you pay attention to baseball at all, you know that it's always reflecting what's going on in society. It's never something separate. It's always enmeshed in the politics and the social issues and, of course, the economics of our world today. And what this story really is, it's a story about a black market for baseball players. It's about this illicit pipeline, these smugglers and investors who are hiring the smugglers they're exploiting the chasm between these two countries, the United States and Cuba, and this dysfunctional relationship that has existed, for my entire lifetime.
Right. Outlasting, seven or eight U.S. presidents. Castro has, I mean. So, and there is, of course, in many of the aspects of this story, the dysfunction is extraordinary to think that I think on his fifth attempt at escaping from Cuba, he was intercepted by a U.S. Coast Guard vessel. They took his autograph and made a big fuss over him, but they sent him back to Cuba. That is because of this peculiar law that unless you actually land with your feet wet on the shore, you can't get asylum.
The fact that we have a policy in this country known as wet foot, dry foot is just, mind-boggling, right? As I was writing this, I was telling my son, he's in college, and explaining to him the story. And I mentioned wet foot, dry foot. And he said, is that real? Is that actually, that's our government rule? Like, he said, it sounds like a kindergarten game. And it is. It's bizarre on a couple different levels. On one hand, it gives Cubans a huge advantage over other immigrants, right? It's a benefit that they receive that others don't. And, ask some Haitians how they feel about wet foot, dry foot, and
right. Certainly
others throughout Latin America. It puts Cubans in a very favored status, and yet there's kind of a don't ask, don't tell quality to it as well. It's like, if you get here, we greet you with open arms. You're home free. But you know what? Don't tell us how you got here.
Right.
And don't get caught while you're doing it.
There's an extra anomaly, though. It's better that you go through a third country, right? Because then you can be up for the draft, right?
Right. Well, that's particularly true for baseball players. But I'm just thinking generally
sure.
for all Cubans.
Yeah, right.
The fact that you have to make it and you have to avoid being intercepted by the Coast Guard automatically is going to put you in the hands of a more sophisticated smuggling organization
right.
because you need to make it. If you're a baseball player and think you're worth many millions of dollars upon your arrival, then you need an even more sophisticated smuggling
right.
organization. And in this case, you need to go to a third country so that you can establish quote-unquote legal residency there, even though
right.
I think everyone knew that Yasiel Puig was not intending to, put down roots in Mexico, but then it allows him to negotiate with every possible baseball
right,
team.
Right, as a free agent. So he gets to this island. Oh, this is his fifth or sixth attempt to get out of the country. Obviously, he's had run-ins with the authorities. At one point, he actually snitched on other people that were trying to get out. And then he arrives in this little island off Cancun. He's in the hands of the guy that took him in the cigarette boat, has a shady past, right? He ends up dead. The people that kidnapped him then start negotiating with agents all around the country, and the clock is ticking like a taxi meter. Every minute that they don't pay up, it costs them an extra $100,000. So to walk us through the early parts of those negotiations.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much everyone has a shady past in this tale, so you gotta be specific when you're talking about who has the shady past. But, you know, remember, this is all an economic equation. There are people in Miami, Cuban Americans, who see this as an investment, right? They are going to put up money in return for getting more down the road. And so these are kind of illicit financiers. And the guy who puts this in motion, shady past, he's an air conditioning repairman in his 20s who's on probation for attempting to steal air conditioners. So, it's the irony that this is the guy who could set this in motion is astonishing. But he puts up $250,000 to get Yaciel out of Cuba. In return,
but not real money. It's a pledge, right?
Correct. He pledges to put up $250,000. Right. And in return, Yaciel is going to pay him 20% of his future earnings, which, you know, in this country would be considered an exploitive contract and usurious.
Right.
And
Castro pays you $17 a month, right?
He was making $17 a month playing for a state-run baseball league. It sounded like a pretty good deal, especially if you think there's many more millions waiting for you after that. And the smugglers who got him out of Cuba and took him to Isla Mujeres, if they had just been paid that $250,000, you and I probably wouldn't even be talking about this story right now, because it would have just been, you know, a transaction, you move on, whatever, it's in the past. But the air conditioning repairman didn't have that $250,000. So for 20 some odd days in the summer of 2012, Yaciel Puig and a few companions who were on that boat with him,
Colorful companions.
Of course, they would have to be, right?
Right, a boxer and a stripper, right?
I don't know if she's a stripper, but she posts like very provocative pictures of herself on Facebook. And and don't forget that there's a Santeria priest who sprinkles a little chicken blood to bless their
right,
voyage.
Right, so they're holed up in this little seedy motel while the phones are ringing and the negotiations are going on. But some of the people surrounding them have ties to Los Zetas, which are these very murderous Mexican drug cartel.
Yeah, absolutely. So the smugglers themselves are mostly Cuban-American. They're in the business of trafficking essentially their own people. And they are ticked off. They're very agitated because they've done the job. They want to get their $250,000, and it's not there. And they're like, we don't play that game. You know, you need to pay us, and we'll do something horrible to Yaciel Puig if you don't pay us. But they also have their own problems because, yes, lurking in the background is the Zeta drug cartel. And these smugglers have to pay a tax to the Zetas, what they call a rite of passage. And one of the smugglers, in fact, sometime earlier, had been kidnapped himself by the Zetas and held hostage for ransom. And when they finally let him go, he was missing a pinky on one of his hands. So they got their own problems, you know, where they're answering to a higher authority in that area. And so the idea of pardoning this debt or just sort of shrugging it off as the cost of business, that wasn't really an option.
But then, well, let me again remind the audience that I'm speaking with Jesse Katz, who's a contributing writer at Los Angeles Magazine and the author of The Opposite Field. A former Los Angeles Times staff writer, he has earned numerous honors over a three-decade career, including two Pulitzer Prizes for Spot News Reporting and the Penn Center USA Award for Literary Journalism. His latest article, featured in Los Angeles Magazine, is Escape from Cuba, Yaciel Puig's Untold Journey to the Dodgers. So let's move to finally gets to Mexico City, and all of these big shots from the U.S. show up, right? The big agents, the representatives of the Dodgers, etc. And he's the kind of guy that the Dodgers are looking for, right, because they've had this terrible slump and they've had this awful owner with his, you know, public spat with his awful, equally awful wife.
Right. Some of your listeners outside the L.A. area may not feel too much sympathy for us here in Dodgerland. There could be some schadenfreude out there. But, yeah, the Dodgers went through a really bleak period under Frank and Jamie McCourt, who sort of used the team as a personal ATM. And the organization almost collapsed. And, you know, this is an organization that has been a pioneer in terms of the internationalization of baseball. They were among the first clubs to really be out there in Latin America. Anyone who was in L.A. in the 1980s is going to remember Fernando Mania, the first great, you know, Mexican baseball player. And all that had come to an end. So the Dodgers had a couple things in mind. They were looking for great players. They suddenly had money to spend. And they also wanted to send a message throughout Latin America that they're back in business to all those young prospects, wherever they be, maybe Cuba, but also the Dominican Republic or wherever, that, you know, this is a club that's got deep pockets. And so they see Yasiel Puig. There's not much time to do a deal because there's some deadlines. The clock's ticking within, you know, baseball's own rules. And they decide they just need to make an offer that he can't refuse. And they propose 7 years, $42 million, which would be a record at the time for a Cuban defector. It's since been broken by another player who's on the White Sox right now. But everyone looked at the Dodgers like, what the heck are you guys doing? You're spending all this money. This is an unproven kid. He's barely played in Cuba. And
because he got into trouble with the authorities trying to get out of the country, right? He was banned from local teams, et cetera.
Yeah, he had his – I mean, anyone who's familiar with his play today and some of his confounding antics and whether it's on the field or off the field will be, you know, perhaps comforted to know he was doing the same things back when he was in Cuba. He was kind of a problem child on the Cuban team, and he spent an entire season on the bench. I think more for not for any sort of political
For stealing sneakers in Holland, right?
Well, there was that was another episode. I mean, you know, he was kind of a headache, and yet he was enormously talented. But towards the end, as it became clear that he was trying to leave the island to come to the U.S. and be in the big leagues, then he was essentially kicked out of baseball in Cuba. Right. And it's odd because that's the punishment there. And yet it's also becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The minute the sports ministry in Cuba says you can't play for the Cuban team, they've essentially written, you know, the exit visa for that player. They're going to be gone.
Right, if they can. It's not – he tried five or six times. It's not apparently that easy to get out, but he did have this air conditioning repairman from Florida fronting his exit, and now we're in Mexico City. They make the deal with the Dodgers. Then they send him off to the farm in Arizona, right? And then he gets kind of Americanized by a guy that bonds with him.
Yeah, there's actually kind of a sweet moment in this story where the Dodgers have a director of a cultural assimilation, which is not a, you know, not a bad thing that they do. And he's a high school wrestling coach, and he's twice Puig's age, and he kind of takes him under his wing and teaches him all these very American, very capitalist, consumerist skills that he didn't have in Cuba, whether it was, you know, reading a menu or, you know, using an ATM card, pumping gas, whatever that might be. And you begin to see, I mean, like Yasiel Puig had to rub shoulders with a lot of unsavory characters, right? You know, he had to take enormous risks and make some compromises that weren't always honorable. And yet he gets here and suddenly you remember, oh, he's just a kid, you know? He was 20 at the time, 21. And it was like having a newborn teenager almost. And he had to – he was wide-eyed and everything was sort of, you know, wondrous to him. And you forget sometimes, you know, when you see a celebrated figure like that with fame and fortune now, that just a couple of years ago he was a bewildered little kid.
So let's get into the more recent chapter where all of his past, and as you point out in your story in the Los Angeles magazine, Escape from Cuba, Yasiel Puig's untold journey to the Dodgers. You yourself had a hard time getting interviews with him. He obviously didn't want to talk to the press. But meanwhile, all of those shady people from his past who got him out, who pledged money and didn't pay up and et cetera, et cetera. They're all sort of fighting over their cut right from this guy. And the boxer that he got out of the country with, who set up in a business, a Santeria business that fails, right? He then turns on his best friend. So let's go into the machinations then of everybody wanting a cut from this brilliant young Cuban player.
Yeah, so when he left Isla Mujeres, he was rescued from there. He escaped from the clutches of the smugglers. And as I mentioned, that's not a debt that they're going to let go. So they came looking for him. He had already signed this contract. He was in the Dodgers organization. And they wanted to track him down to get paid. And it was easier to track down the boxer, this guy, Junior de Spain, who was on the boat with him. And they threatened him. They confronted him. They stuck a gun in his ribs. And they said, you know, tell Yasiel he needs to pay or we're going to kill him. They called Junior's mother back in Cuba, said, where does Yasiel Puig live? Where's his family? We're gonna burn down his house. And if you don't tell us, we're going to come burn down your house too. I mean, this is like, you know, serious business. These are people who don't resolve their disputes in a court of law. They handle it.
They don't go to small claims. They kneecap you, right?
They handle it themselves. And so in the midst of this, Junior, who, you know, was Puig's friend and acquaintance through the sports leagues in Cuba, from the same part of Cuba, Cienfuegos, who had endured this harrowing journey with him and survived this captivity, suddenly is feeling like, you know, he's taking the brunt of this. You know, Yasiel hasn't cleaned up after himself, and Junior's, paying for it. And at a certain point, he begins to cooperate with some lawyers who are suing Yasiel in federal court in Miami. And it's a little separate, a little distinct from the story we're talking about here, but it gets back to that idea of escaping from the island and the fact that Yasiel was an informant at least once, possibly more times, that he testified against the fellow who had allegedly offered him a trip off the island. And this guy was sentenced to 7 years in prison. And, you know,
in Cuba, right?
In Cuba. Mm-hmm. And it's all really troubling stuff. You know, it's sort of troubling that having a discussion about leaving the island is a crime. And it's troubling that Yasiel testified against this guy and, you know, has to take some responsibility for him being in prison. And, you know, it's troubling that there's just a system that makes people have to make those kind of impossible choices. Anyway, this guy who was sentenced is suing Yasiel in a U.S. court in Florida under some victims of torture, you know, international conventions, saying that Yasiel conspired with the Cuban government to, you know, inflict all sorts of horrors on him, and is seeking $12 million. Hard to say that it doesn't look like kind of a shakedown, but, you know, fair enough. They'll have their day in court. But now Junior is cooperating with those lawyers. So right. Even though Junior's not part of the snitch thing, it's really, you know, he's providing some very vivid allegations that kind of give credibility to the plaintiff in that case and of course embarrass Yasiel. And in doing that, he's betraying his friend. But he's also giving us like our first glimpse of what really happened. Had Junior de Spain not submitted an affidavit laying out this kind of blueprint of the journey, I'm not sure that any of us would have ever learned what happened on that boat or in that motel.
Well, but there is there's a body in this, isn't there? It's the dead guy, the guy that took him in the cigarette boat from Cuba to Mexico ends up shot, 13 times in the back?
Of course there's a body in this, Ian, right?
Right. So how does that tie into the story just as we wrap up here?
Yeah, well, as Junior is feeling threatened there in Miami, these guys are coming to him with sticking guns in his ribs. He contacts Yasiel and says, do something about this, brother. Clean up your mess. And Yasiel contacts then one of the other financiers who helped put this in motion. And this guy allegedly says, well, we're going to neutralize the problem. We're going to neutralize the smuggler named Leo. And sure enough, a month later, Leo's bullet-riddled body turns up on a street in Cancun. I should say very clearly there's no evidence linking Yasiel or his people to this murder. It's kind of weird that one of these guys wanted to take credit for that, but maybe that's the bravado and the bluster that you need to survive in that murky world. But nobody was ever arrested or prosecuted for that crime.
So your article then is out in the Los Angeles Magazine that goes on the stands tomorrow, right?
Yes, it's the May issue of LA Magazine. It's been online for the last week at lamag.com. And one cool thing, we did it in English and in Spanish. It's the first time LA Magazine has published a story instantly translated into Spanish.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you. It's a nice, refreshing break from depressing international relations agonies.
So. Well, this is depressing international relations too, but it's colorful.
It's colorful. And again, I thank Jesse Katz, who's a contributing writer at Los Angeles Magazine and the author of The Opposite Field. He's a former Los Angeles Times staff writer, and he's earned numerous honors over a three-decade career, including two Pulitzer Prizes for Spot News Reporting and the Penn Center USA Award for Literary Journalism. His latest article in Los Angeles Magazine is Escape from Cuba, Yasiel Puig's Untold Journey to the Dodgers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.